Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for an ADHD conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. ADHD as in attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder. While I typically have conversations about drugs, the overlap of substance use disorder and mental health disorder is significant. Up to 50% with people who have a substance use disorder also have some type of mental illness. Similarly, there is an overlap between ADHD and substance use disorder, especially as it affects children and adolescents. ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is the most prevalent neurobehavioral disorder and affects 6 to 9% of children and adolescents. That's a lot. There's a link between substance use disorder and ADHD that goes in both directions. Going from substance use disorder to ADHD, the connection is made. In a large study, over 3,500 patients seeking treatment for substance use disorder, 40% of them tested positive for ADHD. In a large study of adolescents with cannabis use disorder, 38% of them also had ADHD. Going in the other direction, from ADHD to substance use disorder, we also see the connection. Children with ADHD have a twofold increased risk of developing substance use disorder, and we know that ADHD symptoms can increase by 30% because of drugs. To learn more about ADHD and drugs, I reached out to Dr. Roberto Alavardia. Dr. Roberto Alavardia is an expert in ADHD. He is a clinical psychologist and lecturer at Harvard Medical School and maintains a private clinical practice. He's also on the professional and scientific advisory boards for children and adults with ADHD, the Attention Deficit Disorder Association, and Attitude Magazine and website. To learn more about Dr. Roberto Alavardia, check out the High Truths show notes. Dr. Roberto Alavardia, welcome to High Truths.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
I'm excited. I've been chasing you down for a while and finally got the opportunity that I've been waiting for. So very excited. You are Mr. Dr. ADHD, really world renowned. So this is a great opportunity for us to learn about the disease. But before we get into that, tell us about you. Like, you are a clinical psychologist. Why did you get into that and how did that lead you to ADHD?
Sure. So I am a clinical psychologist and a clinical instructor in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School in Boston, Massachusetts, where I was born and raised in Boston. I'm a Bostonian through and through. And psychology was actually, looking back, almost, I felt kind of destined in ways for me. I took a psychology class my senior year of high school, and that was it. This is what I'm interested in. And I have ADHD, as we'll talk in more detail what that is. And part of my experience having ADHD is I really didn't like school. I was very bored by it, very understimulated by it in psychology, and to the point where I had no desire to go to college, which, you know, was not an easy conversation, being the youngest of three immigrant, hardworking parents where college education was really emphasized, until my senior year of high school. And I took that psych class and I thought, I love, and I'm going to, I'll go to college for this. And 2 weeks into my freshman year, thought, might as well just go the whole way and just get a PhD. And always just love, I just really love what I do. And specialize in a number of things. So one of my areas of focus for 30 years, I've been researching treating boys and men with eating disorders, which is a very under-recognized population. I co-authored a book years ago called The Adonis Complex, which looks at body image issues and eating disorders in boys and men. And then obsessive compulsive disorder I work with. And then with ADHD, partly through my own experience, specialize in that. And particularly with people with ADHD who also have another condition. So what we call a comorbidity. And the truth is that it's the rule rather than the exception that most people with ADHD do have a comorbid disorder. So whether it's an anxiety disorder, mood issue, eating disorders, substance abuse, as we'll talk about today. And the importance with something like ADHD, most people have heard of it. And I would say that it's one of the most misunderstood conditions because, and I think what's really misunderstood about it is most people think they know what it is when they either know 10% of what it is or really don't know what it is. So I'm glad to be here with you today talking about, you know, is what ADHD actually is and then its relationship with substance abuse and substance dependence. So I come at this from, you know, a very personal perspective. I have two children, an 18 and 16 year old. They both have ADHD. It's a very heritable condition and way of being in the world. And looking at it, and I talk, you know, with my patients about it from a sort of more strength-based model, that it's not a mental illness. It's not even a mental health condition. It's sort of seen as a neurodivergence, you know, sort of neurodiversity, a different way of kind of wiring in the brain, that if we don't acknowledge it, identify it, treat it, could cause real problems for people. And if it's treated, that same kind of way that that brain is constructed could also lend itself to great things for that person, you know, and in terms of problem solving or creativity or indulging in their passions. And I love just disseminating information. And so even in this conversation, the idea that we're educating people to me is really powerful.
That is powerful. I love your story going from I hate school to being a Harvard professor. Okay.
I told my parents I want to be I'll be a drummer. When my dad said, what would you do instead of college? Well, my friend was starting a punk rock band. I'll be the drummer in that band. And that just seemed perfectly reasonable to me.
That's right. Yeah. And that's where parental guidance helps out, huh?
Yes.
So ADHD, it's called a disorder. And interesting that you just called it a neuropathic divergence, but ADHD, attention deficit and disorder. So
yes.
Tell us about what do we need to know and understand, because I probably am one of those 10 percenters.
Yeah. So it's an interest. So it stands for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And the word disorder is in there. And a lot of people, even the ADHD community, will say it really should be called a lot of different things because it gives this assumption that either A, we have no attention span, which is not the case. So the main symptoms of ADHD are the symptoms of attention dysregulation. So for people with ADHD, if we're stimulated and really interested in something, our attention span could be better than somebody and with more endurance than someone without ADHD, what we call the hyperfocus. If we're not interested, it's really hard to focus and pay attention. So I use the analogy of like a light switch, like a dimmer switch in a room that a neurotypical brain could, you know, sure, if they're bored, it might be harder to pay attention for anybody, but they can still do it. They can regulate that more. An ADHD brain is a good old-fashioned light switch. The lights are on or they're off. And so if that stimulation of that interest isn't there, it's not impossible, but it's just much more difficult. So a lot of times, you know, I might hear from parents who are like, I don't think my kid has ADHD because he can play video games for 12 hours straight. And that takes a lot of attention. And I'm thinking, well, but video games are very stimulating. And if they're rewarding for that person with ADHD, we're not going to see a problem with attention if it's rewarding. How is your kid when he has to do something that he might not be so thrilled about? That's where you're going to see it. And so it And ADHD is different for different people. It can manifest in different ways because what's interesting to me could be very different than what's interesting to someone else with ADHD. So, and school isn't always a bad experience for people with ADHD. So I have clients with ADHD who are Harvard University students who really like school and they're really rewarded by that. So you have the attention, you have impulsivity. So this is where people with ADHD might act before really thinking through. And a lot of times, because they're drawn towards very thrill-seeking, pleasure-seeking behaviors, and oftentimes will find themselves in situations sometimes where they'll be like, oh, why did I do that? And can get very down on themselves, or other people can really judge them for either being disrespectful, for interrupting, let's say, when they're not really meaning to be rude. It's just that to hold a thought in one's head and wait for someone else to finish, that's harder for people with ADHD. We're sort of just more impulsive.
I get that sometimes.
Yeah. and then that impulsivity can come out, you know, in different kinds of behaviors. And then there's the hyperactivity piece, which not everyone with ADHD has that hyperactivity piece. I mean, years ago, it would be ADD, which was the more inattentive type, and ADHD was the more hyperactive. It's all called ADHD now, but they say inattentive presentation, hyperactive presentation combined. And that hyperactivity is, those are the people, the kids particularly, that get diagnosed and identified earlier, the ones who have a hard time sitting in their seat, are moving about, fidgeting constantly, very restless. However, we also conceptualize hyperactivity mentally manifesting that, you know, individuals who might be able to sit in their seat, maybe because they're anxious and are not going to want to draw attention or get in trouble, but their minds are racing. And that's particularly true for girls with ADHD who are still vastly underdiagnosed. I mean, there's a myth that boys are more likely to have ADHD. That's not true, that boys are more likely to be identified and diagnosed with ADHD. Than girls. It just manifests a little bit differently in girls. You might see girls with ADHD that tend to internalize the ADHD in ways that they overcompensate with perfectionism and anxiety and stress. So they might get their homework done perfectly, whereas sometimes the other person with ADHD is like, I'm not doing homework. Like I'm just not interested. The big part of ADHD are the executive functions, which are all the cognitive processes that our brain has to do to get things done. And this is where we now understand that ADHD affects every life domain, because every life domain requires executive functions. It requires time management, our ability to prioritize when we have 10 things to do, how to organize, making decisions, regulating our emotions is an executive function. This is where, with particularly developing brains, that someone with ADHD could be up to a third less their chronological age and executive function. So that means that if you have an 18-year-old, they could have the intelligence and the intellectual capacity of an 18 or 25-year-old, super bright, but their executive functions could be that of a 12-year-old. So what one would expect of, let's say, a kid with ADHD going to college and their ability to, you know, do things and get things done, clean their room, all those things, there's a gap there. And that's where a lot of things can fall into that gap. And a lot of misunderstanding can be sometimes of, oh, this person's lazy when they're not lazy. People with ADHD, undiagnosed ADHD, have often have this narrative either put on them or they feel themselves of, I'm lazy, I'm stupid, I'm crazy, to sort of, because it can be very difficult to be like, why can't I get these things done? Why is it so hard for me to, you know, go to sleep at a regular time? Because with ADHD, it's actualizing your intentions. Like we joke, but it's kind of true that it should be called intention deficit disorder, because we have the intentions. It's almost like not knowing what to do. It's doing what we know and executing and actualizing our intentions. So the experience for many people with ADHD sometimes is this gap between their values and their behaviors, which can be misinterpreted as, oh, that person doesn't really care about, let's say, their health because they're using substances. They're not sleeping well. They're eating junk food. They clearly don't care. Well, no, they could really, really, really care. But the impulsivity, the need for stimulation, all of the things that we'll get into today just make it harder to work through.
Right. I'm wondering, going back, and this is probably the, you know, like misunderstanding, is that I was a very hyper kid. And I was a very good student and I could complete tasks. But I feel like, you know, if I was born today with as rambunctious as I was, not always listening to my parents, that I would have been diagnosed with ADHD. And certain professions, I'm an emergency physician, that my colleagues are also, they're bouncing everywhere. But do a good job of it. It's one of my favorite type of meetings of having a group of emergency physicians together with psychiatrists. It's like, they're doctors like talking the whole meeting, and the psychiatrist didn't say a word that entire hour. Go ahead.
Just quickly, I mean, just on that, you know, well, this is what's interesting is that, you know, with ADHD, what we know now is completely different than what we knew, you know, years ago. I mean, I'm 51. I was not diagnosed with ADHD as a child, because when I was a child, the kids that were diagnosed with first, what we knew about it, again, was much less than what we know now. But the kids who were diagnosed back then were the kids with conduct disorders, like the kids who were like burning the school down. And I was a very mischievous kid. I was a very impulsive kid, but I had good social skills. I was a class clown, but the teachers would even laugh at my jokes. So I was never disrespectful. I never, you know, would cross that line of hurting someone's feelings. Like, people's feelings really mattered to me. I was a very sensitive kid, but I, you know, was not a goody two shoes either. And it is interesting looking at, so the question, I guess, would be, to what extent does it become a problem? Because in school, like, I did well, like in school, but I could tell you behind the scenes, I procrastinated on everything. In high school, I never read a book that was assigned to me from cover to cover. I fatigued so quickly with reading that I would skip around and I would just get the gist of it. I'd write papers overnight. I was, you know, cramming for exams. But what you talk about too with ER, there are many people with ADHD who are ER. I have a good friend of mine who's an ER doctor, and he said, look, because we are drawn, and when we talk about the brain and neurochemistry of ADHD, especially in relation to substances, the ADHD brain by baseline, we know, is like a bored brain. We have lower levels of dopamine, which is a reward neurotransmitter. So people with ADHD are really drawn towards high stimulating things. Now, for some, everyone has their threshold of what that is, but being an ER physician, you have to be grounded enough exposed to very high stimulating situations. Now, that doesn't mean you definitely have ADHD, like every ER doctor has ADHD. However, I can tell you that
it's the entry criteria.
that field definitely appeals to a lot of people with ADHD. I mean, even in my work, I'm interacting with people all the time, which I love. So I'm never, ever bored. I've never had a boring day and what I do, but that's not coincidental. Like, I have to do something that I love, because if I were in a work or a job, I mean, I don't even call this my job. I call it what I do, because it's so aligned with my sense of self, but it is so highly stimulating. People are just inherently fascinating to me. Everyone's story is interesting, and helping elevate people to a more optimal, authentic living is something I feel very passionately about. So it is interesting to think about, right, like, if you were growing up today, how would that be? And I think that's where that level of how much impairment, or, you know, where it would sort of get in your way, does it become a problem?
Right. And maybe, I don't even know, going back, maybe it was a problem for me as a child and not diagnosed, but it worked for me as an adult, and I guess I found the right thing. But I think you're right. We are, whatever, adrenaline junkies, and have to be. Mm-hmm. I relate to that. I don't like to be bored statement. Mm.
Oh yeah, it's intolerable to me. I mean, for people with ADHD, it really is a very dysphoric feeling to be bored, and we would do anything. I mean, what we know with the ADHD brain is, we are, again, drawn towards stimulation, and everything that's pleasurable is stimulating, but not everything that's stimulating is pleasurable. And which means, like, anxiety, danger, conflict are very stimulating activities in the brain, not pleasurable. But what we know is an ADHD brain would unconsciously rather lean into those things than to be bored. And so you'll often see that's part of some of the impulsivity that you'll see with people with ADHD, where someone else might say, why would you put yourself in that situation? That's so crazy. That's so dangerous. And it's not that they're consciously thinking, I need stimulation, but it's almost like their brain is leading them, you know, into that. Or why would you be an ER doctor? That's so stressful. Like there's so much stress. But to a certain kind of brain, that stimulation can actually be grounding, you know, in a way.
Yeah.
So
not a boring day, right? Every shift.
Never a boring day.
30 years.
Exactly.
It's exciting. Now, is it something, given that the brain is growing, I could see, you know, that executive function, it's probably, you know, at the height of adolescence or those years where the brain is growing, maybe ADHD manifests itself a lot. And then can you grow out of it? Or learn to deal with it?
Yes. See, this is a great question because, believe it or not, it wasn't until the mid-90s, which is not that long ago, I was in college in the mid-90s, that the concept that adults had ADHD was even on the map, which is kind of absurd, really, to think that, okay, once we turn 18, it just magically disappears. It's kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. So we know that, in fact, no, people don't outgrow it. What changes, though, is, you know, we have, in some sense, like traditional schooling, which most of us go through, is a controlled experiment, you know, in a way where you can really see big differences between people with ADHD and learning disabilities and people who don't have ADHD, because they're in this classroom 8 hours a day for 5 days a week. Now, when we turn 18, we have more options and choices. So in my case, in college, I did great. Like college and my PhD was honestly an easier, smoother experience for me than high school because I loved it. I chose the classes that I wanted to participate in. I knew I wanted to be a psychologist, so it mattered to me. There was relevance to it. Now that doesn't mean the ADHD goes away. I still had problems procrastinating and writing papers, except in college, I did do all the reading as opposed to high school where I didn't care to do it. But I couldn't manage my time well in doing it. Like it came out in other ways, impulse control behaviors and things like that, that I had to regulate and manage. So it just shows itself in different ways. Now, a career, if you're someone with ADHD and you're kind of in the wrong career track or job, it's going to be really, really difficult. And so a lot of the work I do with patients is finding that fit. And that fit is so important, the fit of who we relate to, our friends, our partners, the job we have. It's, you know, I remember in third grade, we had to write a paragraph of a fictional character that we related to. And strangely, I mean, this is so diagnostic. I mean, little did I know then what I was saying. And all the boys wrote the Hulk and Superman. And I thought, you don't relate to them. Maybe you want to be them, but you don't relate to them. I wrote that I related to Goldilocks from Goldilocks and the Three Bears. And my teacher was so curious about that. She said, why? And I remember writing, well, Goldilocks thought this bed was too big, too hard, and this was too soft, and this was just right. And the porridge was too hot, and the porridge was too cold, and this was just right. And I remember I drew a line on the piece of paper, a long line, and I said, most people's just right is this long line. And then I drew a shorter line. I said, my just right is this line. And it's almost when I think back to that, I'm like, I pat myself on the back because I was speaking to some real truth of mine, which is I would be very unhappy in a job that just was almost even mediocre. Like it would make me more unhappy than it probably would the average person. Most people don't really love, most people, unfortunately, I think, don't love what they do, but they do it, you know, which is great. I mean, they have to make a living in doing it.
Is it great? Wouldn't it be better to have someone intervene in your life early and make you have a job where you're
I think so, 100%. I mean, I'm in some ways, I almost partly admire people that can do that. And then I feel sorry for them at the same time. It's this weird, like, but I can't. Like, I was terrified, like, as an adolescent honestly, of like growing up and being an adult, because I thought I can't be bored and stuck in something I don't want to do. And my dad, I mean, I had models in my life. Like my dad was a teacher. He loved it. He always came home with a smile on his face. So I had that as a model. And at the same time, I was well aware that that was not the norm. Most of my friends' parents did not come home with a big smile on their face from work. So you don't outgrow it. It just shows itself in different ways. And this is where particularly understanding the executive functioning component is huge, because if you don't have it identified and diagnosed, and you're struggling with getting things done, and you're struggling with emotional dysregulation, which can lend itself to depression and anxiety. You're now, if, let's say you're struggling with a substance abuse issue. Nobody is thinking ADHD at that point. They're thinking depression, anxiety, substance abuse, which are real, obviously real problems. But if you're not addressing sometimes the underlying neurology of it, then you're missing the boat. So that's why it wasn't even thought of, because people would think ADHD was just a school issue, like an academic arena issue, or an issue with quote unquote focus. And it wasn't until Ned Halliwell wrote and John Rady wrote a book called Driven to Distraction in the mid 90s that they talked about adult ADHD. And then a lot of adults were like, whoa, this is me. And a lot of adults like myself who were not diagnosed as kids, and at the same time related to all of this other stuff, I was like, oh, wait a minute, I can see myself in this.
I would say, again, can't help but take it personal. If I was diagnosed with ADHD as a child, the fear is, well, if you got that diagnosis, that means you're going to be on Adderall and Vyvanse and be started on medications. And you know, would I have really have benefited for that? It feels, I don't know, better like I survived even without those type of medications. And even to today, if you have that diagnosis, does that mean you have to be on medications? You did well, excelled and became a Harvard professor without those drugs. Mm.
Yeah. So no, not everyone with ADHD has to take medication. And at the same time, part of the education is destigmatizing, you know, medication and educating people of how life-changing medication can be for people with ADHD. So I did not have, you know, medication growing up, but I could tell you, I absolutely would have benefited from it in high school. College, I think, again, because I had so much of that drive and motivation, you know, it probably wouldn't have been as necessary, but high school, 100%. Like, I was so fatigued in high school. Like, so I would fall asleep constantly in classes. I don't even remember first period, which is the first class of the day, all 4 years of high school, because I don't even think my brain woke up until like 10 a.m. I have a history of chronic sleep issues and every sleep disorder you can imagine. I was a sleepwalker, sleep talker, sleep paralysis, night terrors, sleep apnea, you know, all of that, which is very associated with ADHD. Again, very impulsive. Now, luckily, I didn't, you know, it didn't cause great harm, but I did very dangerous things when I was young that could have absolutely, given one or two variables, could have really impacted my health and my life. So no, not everyone has to be on medication. And at the same time, we want people to know that, you know, ADHD medications, which are traditionally the stimulant medications, are some of the most widely researched and most trial friendly of all the medications, because you kind of know the day or two that you take it, what it's going to do. It's not like an antidepressant that you have to be on for 2-3 weeks to collect data on. And I've seen people who have struggled with, you know, I have a patient now who's an attorney, and he would have to reread things 3 times to comprehend it, because working memory is an executive function. And our working memory is that information we have to hold in real time. So when we read, we're holding all these words in our memory. So by the time we get to the end of a page, we can remember it. He, as an attorney, he has to read a lot of legal briefs. He started taking, as an adult, when he was diagnosed with ADHD, taking medication. And he said, oh my gosh, it has cut my reading time by by 75%. He said he's just reading so much more with more endurance, more fatigue, less distractibility. And he's also someone in recovery for substance abuse. And he said, and this is what studies show, which is so important, especially in light of what we're talking about on your podcast, is studies show for people with ADHD that stimulant treatment is actually associated with a less risk of relapse with substance abuse. And what bothers me and other people in the ADHD world is that there are still drug rehabilitation programs or in some community sobriety communities that look at stimulant treatment as a violation of sobriety, which is very wrong. Because and I always preface, for people with ADHD, if you don't have ADHD, you shouldn't be taking ADHD medication. But for a lot of my patients with ADHD who are in recovery, taking medication is associated with less relapse, because if their lives are more in control and their stress levels are less, if they're getting better sleep and they're attending to their health. And what we know about that medication is it's basically medicating those dopamine sort of deficiency, which might have them crave substances less so. And that's what's so important to understand, is that medication, no, not everyone has to take it. And at the same time, it doesn't also have to be the last resort to something. It doesn't have to be something that people, especially parents, have to feel bad about, that their kids are taking medication. Any more than if you were diabetic, we shouldn't have shame taking insulin. If you have weak eyesight, like I do, I have to wear contacts or else I won't be able to see you. You'd be this fuzzy blur.
But I see a different, you know, as an emergency physician in California, methamphetamine is rampant. And I see a lot of patients who have a methamphetamine use disorder, and yet they say, oh, and I have ADHD, and they're on the Adderall. And I'm thinking, you don't need your Adderall or Vyvanse if you're taking so much stimulants. And that's not, you know, there. I don't know. I see one way or the other, something is not right in that equation.
Oh, yeah. No, certainly. I mean, what we know is that people with ADHD carry a significantly higher risk of addiction, of any kind of addiction. So it could be drugs, alcohol, food, pornography, gambling, you name it. So when you said earlier, adrenaline junkies, we say we're kind of like dopamine junkies, like we, whatever it is that's reward. So in studies of groups of people who are struggling with drug addiction, you will see a high prevalence of ADHD. So that's valid in that diagnosis, and they may be prescribed medication, but that doesn't mean that, you know, everyone always uses, people can misuse that, you know. But the problem isn't the medication. The problem is that either maybe that medication isn't the right dose, maybe they're on the wrong medication, and or maybe there are other variables at play that then still lead them to abuse other, you know, substances, certainly.
But as a clinician, if I see somebody who has a rampant substance use disorder in the emergency department, and they're positive for, you know, I call it the Christmas tree lit up, you know, fentanyl, marijuana, everything. And then I see a medication of a stimulant that they're prescribed that. I'm thinking, like, why do they need to add that? Something's wrong. Like, you should maybe not be on that stimulant medication. Is that wrong?
Well, they shouldn't be taking fentanyl and meth and meth. You know, I mean, those are the things they really, we want to, you know, get
but
them
off. But are you adding to that problem by having that prescription that's like really a drop in the ocean with all the other stimulants?
Oh, it could. Oh, absolutely. Oh, I'm sure. When you're bringing any substances in it, I mean, these medications, you know, in combination of substances, then absolutely. Like if I'm working with someone who is dependent on cannabis and they're taking ADHD medication because they do have ADHD, but they're not, you know, they're not there yet with sobriety. What we know is that alcohol, you know, cannabis, other substances will decrease the effectiveness of medication. So when I tell my patients, look, if you're taking this medication, part of taking a medication is a responsibility now of doing the work, because it's, we say pills don't teach skills. It's not just, you know, the ADHD treatment is not just here's a medication and now you're off. It's like, no. Now the medication is allowing you to be on a certain level where you can take in the skills, the strategies, all of the executive functioning training and all the work. But if you're not sober, you're kind of violating your own contract of that medication, because we know physiologically the effectiveness of that medication is being reduced by those substances, which now almost can nullify the, even taking the medication at that point. If you're smoking weed 12 hours a day, exactly, then the question is, maybe we have to revisit this and the medication isn't going to be very useful. But if you are actively working on your sobriety, we know that medication can be helpful in that process. But that's where really we have to assess where somebody is in that process.
I like that explanation. I like that explanation. You're violating your own contract. And it actually validates what my thoughts are. It's like, you should not be on this medication right now at this point in your life. Right. Because sometimes I get, well, can you refill this? And it's like, no, I really don't think I should be. Are we over-prescribing stimulants? One of the graphs that we have from our PDMP system, the system that looks at controlled prescriptions, that we've really ended the opioid prescription epidemic. We've honed down on opioids. Also, we've honed down on benzodiazepines. But in the same graph, the stimulant prescriptions have gone up.
Yes.
I imagine you would say, no, we're doing the right thing. But I'm wondering, are we prescribing it in general?
Yeah. So what we know, and just to be clear, I don't prescribe, I'm a psychologist, I'm not a psychiatrist, so I don't prescribe medications. But just in terms of talking about this on a general level, that just even at first with just diagnosis of ADHD, that one of the misperceptions is that ADHD is overdiagnosed, that there are people who are diagnosed with ADHD, more people who are diagnosed with ADHD than have ADHD. Now, certainly there are some people, and I'll do consultations all the time where people come in and they've been diagnosed with ADHD and they may have a bipolar disorder. Maybe there's an underlying substance abuse issue, a sleep disorder, depression. I mean, that's the thing with ADHD. It can mimic and overlap because it can look like a lot of other things. It could be a personality disorder. At the same time, what we also know is that ADHD can give rise to all of those things. And studies, empirical studies, show that it's actually the opposite, that there are far more people who have ADHD who are not diagnosed. And this is particularly true for older people, for any people over the age of 30 who grew up at a time where the conception of ADHD was very limited to a certain, you know, demographic of behavior, of gender, of, you know, socioeconomic status. I mean, there are lots of studies now looking in to even just ethnically that you'll see it overdiagnosed sometimes in certain communities of people of color, sometimes underdiagnosed in people of color or in impoverished communities. So we know that overall that it's more underdiagnosed. So with stimulant medication, I don't think it's necessarily that it's overprescribed. I think particularly with the pandemic, what the pandemic really brought out, and in my work certainly, is when people had to work from home, that there were, granted, there were some of my ADHD patients that absolutely preferred that because they had their home domain, they set it up their way, there was a lot of flexibility, which kind of could work with their ADHD brain. The majority of my ADHD patients, that was a brutal process. And I can tell you from my experience, I have this beautiful office. And even though I was seeing all my patients virtually, I still came into the office every single day like it was nothing changed, because I don't like to work from home. And it's not anything wrong with being at home. It's just I need that sort of separation and that structure. And people with ADHD, we do best with a certain accountability, structure, and reward. That's what helps boost our executive functions. And so we did see this sharp rise of stimulant treatment because we saw a sharp rise of diagnosis of ADHD, because there were a lot of people that were like, whoa, something has really shifted here and I cannot get anything done without my boss in the office across the hall, and that accountability and people really recognizing that and seeing that. So are there some people that are prescribed that probably don't have ADHD? Absolutely. But I would say that, you know, the majority of people who are prescribed stimulant have ADHD. It's just that it's being seen and recognized. And this is where with younger people, the upside of social media, because there are a lot of downsides to it, but one of the upsides is it works at destigmatizing a lot of these kinds of conditions. And so with a lot of young people I work with, they don't feel as stigmatized by having ADHD or even taking medication as what I would have even seen 15 years ago, because it's sort of more understood. And at the same time, I'm always sensitive. I don't want, again, medication to be looked at as the end all be all, that, again, it goes back to pills don't teach skills. Like, we're going to take medication and that's it. It's like, no. This is now the beginning of the work, you know, of everything that you have to do.
Yeah. And before we get off the medication thing, if you're on it, does it mean you have to be on it for the rest of your life? Or do you take drug holidays, or you have periods where you're getting your outside dopamine and you don't need to be on it as much?
Absolutely. No, you absolutely don't have to be on it for the rest of your life. And a lot of people I work with ADHD don't have to take it every day with stimulants. Now, non-stimulants like Strattera, that you do have to take every day until you decide to stop taking it. But with stimulants, yes, some people have drug holidays, but it all depends on what the medication is treating. And that's where, again, there's both this universality of people with ADHD that we all can kind of relate to each other in certain things, and there's a lot of differences and diversity. So I have, let's say, an 8-year-old patient now who is very, very impulsive. And medication literally has changed his life. I mean, this was a kid that almost got hit by a car 3 or 4 times, really put himself in very dangerous, harmful situations that were life-threatening to him. He was so impulsive. And medication he's like, oh my gosh, I wish I had had this years ago. He's grounded.
As an 8-year-old?
As an eight-year-old.
How many years before that can you go? It's only like.
Oh, yeah. You know, but he remember even at 4 or 5 years old, I mean, things that he would do and he's a very bright kid that he would say, I don't know why I did that. I just can't stop myself. I don't know why. He had no friends, because he would blurt things out. He would just be super hyper in a way that would be very off-putting to his peers, and be very isolated and be, I mean, even at 8, you know, if you don't have any friends, your self-esteem, you already know I'm different in this way and different in a bad way. So for him, there are no drug holidays, because every day it's not just about school. It's in fact, it was more what was happening at home, that impulsivity. Now, if I'm working with a med student right now at Harvard Medical School who has ADHD, and I made it
to Harvard Medical School.
Right. But with an ADHD diagnosis and treatment, and he had medication treatment throughout high school that really helped him, because middle school, when the executive demands started to increase, he did elementary school, not an issue, because he's a super smart kid. He can navigate that. Middle school, you started to have more demands, and he was finding it was like harder to pay attention, get work done, and education was really important to him. And then he got diagnosed with ADHD and started medication as a 10th grader, and really was very helpful. But he notices like he has a lot of skills under his belt, and the medication is really helpful during like high exam times and things like that, you know, or people who are in jobs or maybe in certain projects. But for a lot of people, they might need the medication almost as a scaffolding, and they build in strategies and skills, and then eventually are like, okay, I don't need the medication anymore. And then there are some people that do take it for the rest of their lives. It really varies.
Yeah, interesting. It's interesting you say that, but, you know, it reminds me about Harvard Medical School. I know that when, I don't know if this is still the case, but when you would take the SAT test, I remember that for my children, that it's a time test, and that time is extremely stressful to mm-hmm. questions down in that time. But if you had an ADHD diagnosis, then you get all the time and you don't get that stress. And I thought like, wow, that must, for someone who doesn't have the disorder, that seemed really nice.
Yeah. And that wouldn't, you know, obviously I wouldn't support someone who truly does not have ADHD to be saying that. But even with that, I think, again, that's one of those things, you still have to have an assessment and everything that I mean, that doesn't happen as commonly as people would think it does. But that's a good example, because when I took the SATs, and this is where I definitely could have benefited, I fell asleep in the SATs. It was so so many hours. It felt so long. And I literally fell asleep for 45 minutes. And I remember waking up and I had missed a whole section. I bombed it. And then my guidance counselor said, you have to take it again. Like, you did so bad. I'm like, I am not taking that test again. It was like, I thought it was criminal that a test should be that long. And that, so one of the few ways I acquiesced, because I was a little bit rebellious as a teenager, and I was like, fine, I'll take it again. I was awake and I only got 50 points higher. I just did the endurance of that test was not, and it again, not interesting. Now, if I'm reading something or writing something that I'm super interested in, I could do that for 14 hours straight. Like, I wrote my dissertation in basically a week and a half, which I wouldn't recommend, because I was writing it literally 20 hours a day because I was so in that flow. So I could pull that off. But that was really, really hard. And honestly, time and a half wouldn't have helped me, because even with folks with ADHD, it's not, sometimes more time just means more time to get distracted. Whereas for other people, it is more time to process the information, because again, those executive functions, aren't working the same way.
Interesting. Now, you said you have ADHD, which you very open about, and your kids do too. And yes. Is there a hereditary, you were saying, obviously, a hereditary component to this?
100%. Absolutely. ADHD is one of the most heritable. It's as heritable as height and intelligence. So if you have ADHD, you have about a 70% chance that you're going to have a kid with ADHD. If you have two kids, about a 35% chance both will have it. And I could tell you, I could have diagnosed my son prenatally with ADHD because anytime we got an ultrasound, the radiologist would be like, whoa, he's active. Like, he was active and he was born dramatically. I mean, he is his father's son. I mean, we're so alike on so many levels that you can almost see. But what's interesting is, and this is where this intersectionality, he's growing up, in the 2024 as an 18-year-old with social media and the internet. I didn't have that, thankfully. My parents kind of knew who their kid was, even though we didn't have that label of ADHD. They got cable the day I went to college, which I was so offended by at the time, because I begged them to have, I'm a music guy. Like, I wanted my MTV. They did not. And I love television. We had one television in the house. There was no way we were going to get a television in our bedroom. There was really nothing to do after 11 o'clock, all my programs. So you kind of went to bed. If I had the internet, oh my gosh, that would have been, I would have never slept. I would have been on that phone, YouTube, watching my favorite bands, chatting with friends. It would have been a real problem. Now, that's why as a parent, I was I was more strict than other parents were with my kids about sleep and about social media. But, they've grown up knowing ADHD is just talked about. And we, again, we almost look at it as if we manage it and treat it, it's also the thing we kind of embrace about ourselves. That part of me that, that hyperactive sort of intense part is also the passionate part of me that makes me love what I do. It makes me love music. It's that same, and that's how I want people to look at it. It's like a coin with its heads and tails. The tails are the part, the slippery slopes that we have to be careful about, and the heads are the strengths. I am a very creative problem solver. People with ADHD, we get so impatient that it can lend itself to finding more efficient ways of doing things. So that informs
that.
Yeah, that informed my parenting very much. And so my kids are growing up in a very different time, and I'm trying to help them sort of build those skills and manage and also empathize with them to say, I get it. So when they get distracted with things, and they're good students, but they both also have dyslexia, which I should also mention that 50 to 60% of folks with ADHD have a learning disability. Dyslexia is one, which affects reading, spelling and writing, dysgraphia, which affects writing and fine motor movements, dyscalculia, which affects mathematics. I definitely had those issues as well. But again, they were always kind of under the surface and, you know, and whatnot. My son's dyslexia was quite severe. Like, it was very evident, and he needed that special remediation to get to where he's at now. And, but they, when they say, oh, it was so boring, you know, at school or this, I'm like, I get it. I understand that. And we have to figure out ways to work through it.
Yeah. So, and is there an environmental effect that can cause? It could be, like, right? Like, if you're a boring environment, that's going to give you more symptoms than if you have a stimulating environment. And what the definition of boring versus stimulating is different to every person.
Yeah. So what we know is, so it's largely genetic, and there are genes that are mapped to ADHD and traits of ADHD, like novelty seeking, sensation seeking, and, you know, again, that neurochemistry that we see. So with environmental triggers, that there are certain environmental conditions that can lend themselves to attention dysregulation, certainly to, you know, let's say you grow up without access, you know, to certain, you know, like you said, like stimulating things, that it can be very difficult to regulate that. But largely in terms of what we think about with ADHD, because it's not just attention, you know, or just impulsivity, it's really this whole umbrella, that if anything, what we find is the environmental conditions are still operating under the kind of hereditary conditions. So, for example, kids with ADHD will often, most of the time, have at least one biological parent with ADHD. Now, if that biological parent did not get their ADHD identified, managed, treated, the household could be a bit chaotic, could be very stressful. That parent might be late for things all the time, which could be very stressful. They might not be able to be cooking healthy dinners, because that requires executive functioning, which could lead to more reliance on fast foods and processed food. The parent could have a substance abuse issue to self-medicate their ADHD. So those kids are growing up in an environment that certainly is not conducive to their health, but it's not that has caused the ADHD. It's, if anything, it's the biology that's causing the environment that then is exacerbating, you know, the ADHD. Just like they would, studies before would find that, like, maternal smoking during pregnancy is a risk factor for ADHD. Now, certainly no one would say that there's anything good about smoking cigarettes, period, but certainly smoking cigarettes when you're pregnant. But guess what? Moms who smoke cigarettes during pregnancy clearly have impulse control issues, because they know that it's not good for the baby, but they can't help themselves. Yeah. So the likelihood is that they have ADHD. And so there's a biological transmission and an environmental, or a genetic transmission, and now a biological and environmental transmission that is certainly exacerbating that existing ADHD.
Right. And we're talking about the overlap now of ADHD and substance use disorder, especially in adolescence. And I imagine in adolescence, you see cannabis use disorder associated. Yes. More than other medications. Is that true? And what harms are you seeing cannabis, and even now with the high dose THC,
my gosh,
making ADHD worse?
So harmful. You know, people with ADHD are at higher risk for any substance that rewards their brain. And cannabis is a substance that not only is not seen as harmful, but is being marketed to young people as being helpful, as being medicinal, as being therapy, being medicine. Right. And there
How
are
many people
some
do you have
medicinal
that come to you that say, oh, I need to use my cannabis for my ADHD. I get that a lot.
Oh, all the time. All the time.
Yeah.
And they justify it. And
you're ADHD expert. So what do you tell them?
Oh, I tell them it is not helping. Number one. Well, first I tell them, I understand why this is appealing to you, because we can't and shouldn't moralize addiction and dependence. Mm-hmm. or judge. We want to first come from a place of, this is clearly doing something for this person. That's why they're doing it. I get it. I totally understand. I have a very addictive personality myself. I get that. So I will first start with, I understand how cannabis is helping you focus in the short term. It might help you go to sleep at night because it's hard for people with ADHD to shut their minds off at the end of the night. Maybe it's helping you regulate your moods and not having you be so intense. Maybe you're not as hyperactive. I get, maybe it's making you feel less bored. It is doing all of those things on the short term. Now, this is what the research shows on the long term. And I, when I did a presentation in 2020, and I really delved into the literature, I really went into this thinking, okay, how harmful is it? I mean, you know, it's like I grew up at a time too in the 80s where they would say like, oh, reefer madness and weed. And I was like, oh, no one really believed it was that bad. But we are now seeing younger people engage in the use of cannabis at higher potencies and more frequently with more accessibility. That is the difference between somebody kind of tapping you on the head and hitting you in the head with the hammer. Like, it's all of those factors really, you know, and how the body and the brain take in all of that. And high THC, whether it's someone dabbing, you know, and again, the vaping and all of that. So then I share with my patients, this is what it's actually doing to your brain. And the problem with cannabis is it's very insidious. That people, you almost don't see it because it's not, I often will say it's not what people see as happening that's the problem. It's what's not happening. Meaning, like, if somebody is taking acid, they get hallucinations. Like, they here are these what we call positive symptoms, the things that are appearing that people can say, okay, clearly this is, you know, maybe not good for my brain. With cannabis use, it's what it's almost degrading. That becomes the problem. It degrades all the executive functions over time, which is exacerbating their ADHD. All the physical effects of what it can do, you know, in terms of heart, you know, in terms of for developing brains, it's literally cutting neuronal growth. So it's, you know, for people, especially if they're using throughout the period of brain development, they're compromising their brain's ability to process information that could be permanent if they do it so intensely and with frequency. And then to say, and what's interesting is I'll have patients say, I don't want to go on medication. Cannabis is my medication. I'm like,
all the time. It's like, I don't want to, I hear it from adults and kids. Well, I don't want to take, you know, pain medicines, or I don't want to take depression medicines, or I don't want to take medications. I'm just going to be natural and take this instead.
Exactly. Well, that's again, that marketing, which again, we are up against a multi-million, if not billion-dollar marketing campaign to redefine cannabis as being treatment, as being medicinal. And so
healthy,
when I
natural
and healthy, natural, exactly, organic. And I tell them, look, I understand the appeal, but this is what the research shows. And when I present that and they see that, it almost is this sort of reorganization of, oh, okay, really? It does that? It's that bad in that way? And I also tell them, look, you know, the weed today is not the weed that your fathers and grandfathers might have been, you know, smoking. It's like, it's a very different, it almost should be called something different. It's like a very different substance. So people with ADHD, we are at higher risk for that. And studies show that even amongst substance abusers, people with ADHD tend to abuse more intensely and more frequently. So even among substance abusers, having ADHD increases your risk of overdose, increases your risk of fatality, increases your risk of just using it more. And it's not just dependence in terms of it, like a daily addiction, even with abuse, like we see with alcohol abuse, that people with ADHD, I have lots of clients who are like, I don't really have a problem with alcohol. I don't drink every day. Like, I just drink a couple times a month. But when they drink, they might have 20, 25 drinks and blackout. That's abuse. That's an alcohol abuse episode. And that's the thing with ADHD, we have a hard time regulating things, and it could be very all or nothing. So it's so important. If anything I want people to take away from this is, if you have ADHD, to get treatment, to get it identified, whether medication is part of it, the behavioral skills, getting the right support, especially if substances are an issue for you, to understand if you are not treating your ADHD, you are undermining the treatment of anything else. And we know this with all comorbid disorders, whether it's anxiety, a mood disorder, that studies show untreated ADHD has that ability to undermine the treatment, because even doing therapy requires executive function. You have to sit with a therapist for 50 minutes and regulate your attention and do exercises that they might have you do. My ADHD patients sometimes will forget that homework assignment that they were supposed to do. And that's part of the treatment. That's what we have to work with. So that's what I want people to sort of get away.
Dr. Olivardia, thank you so much. You're such a great spokesperson for ADHD, for the science and for the people who have the disease. You bring your experience. There's a lot of hope, right? If you have ADHD, you can
absolutely
up and be a Harvard professor. And you have kids, right? You have great hope and aspirations for them, even though they have this problem.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And even, you know, I wouldn't even refer to it as a disease. I mean, I refer to it as it's a neurodiverse condition, a way that the brain is wired, that if it's not, again, if it's not managed, if it's not treated, could lend itself to a lot of impairment in people's lives. But if it's managed and treated, could be actually something that you almost look at as an asset in your life. So, which is very different than like a disease, where a disease is always not a good thing. Like, we want to eradicate a disease. But with ADHD, and I would say this is true for a lot of us with ADHD, most of us wouldn't say we want to get rid of it all. We just want to almost tweak it and fine tune it and, you know, get it a little bit more grounded and regulated. But there's absolutely hope with education, with support, with community, and with treatment.
That's great. I relate to that. And I thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
And being a great voice for people who need that education.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.